own realization. The larger notion that spiritual awareness can bring material fulfillment, that perhaps you can have nirvana, a happy marriage, and the shiny new car, helps explain how 11 million fans of Oprah even heard of him in the first place. Taking the kink out of kinky. The lineage that goes from Esalen to Est to Eckhart is one of increasing self-exploration, of pushing beyond the limits of what was considered safe or acceptable. Price and the Beats gave us a way to get past the taboos of primal expression and mental illness. Erhard broke down the taboo segregating spiritual merit from material success. The Human Potential movement normalized the use of ecstatic practices for psychological growth. Along the way, we came up with broader versions of ourselves and new ways to interact with each other. But nowhere were taboos more visibly challenged than in the realm of sexuality. And while the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s increased the amount of sex people were having, we want to focus here on a more recent development, what kind of sex people are having today. Specifically, how a growing subset of experiences formerly defined as kinky, meaning taboo and outside the norm, are giving more people access to ecstasy than ever. In 2014, we were invited to San Francisco to speak about the overlap between the neuroscience of flow, meditation, and sexuality, and see the cutting edge of this latter domain up close. Justine Dawson, the CEO of One Taste and our host for the weekend, escorted us to our chairs in the front row of a packed auditorium, ascended the stage, dropped her pants, and lay back on a massage table. One Taste's founder, Nicole Dedone, entered stage right. Wearing a gray wool dress and a large black apron, she snapped on a pair of latex gloves, dipped her forefinger and thumb into a jar of artisanal lube, and went to work. The reclined Dawson began mewling. With an entertainer's flair for the theatrical, Nicole paused, swiveled on a stilettoed black boot, and punched her hand in the air like a rock guitarist. The audience began calling out words to describe their own experience. "Tingling in my groin," one woman announced. "Heat," said another. "Tumescence," blurted a software engineer. On the One Taste website, they described their central practice as OMing, short for orgasmic meditation, and we just witnessed a main stage demonstration by the masters. A tightly circumscribed, almost ritualized practice, OMing involves stroking the upper left quadrant of a woman's clitoris for exactly 15 minutes without attachment to outcome or expectation of reciprocity. Their goal is to create a turned-on woman, one who is neurochemically saturated, physically open, and emotionally empowered. And they're not the first, by any means, to use sex as a trigger for non-ordinary states of awareness. From the ancient wine, women, and song to the boomers, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, erotic techniques have always featured heavily on Promethean playlists. The search for personal transformation, including through sex, led to the Oceanside hot tubs at Esalen, explains Patricia Brown in her New York Times article on orgasmic meditation. One Taste is but the latest stop on this sexual underground, weaving together strands of radical individual freedom, Eastern spirituality, and feminism. Their message appears to be getting traction. One Taste has centers in Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, London, and Sydney, along with a dozen other cities. They've received largely favorable coverage in The Atlantic, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Time, and dozens of other publications. The clincher is always a female journalist who tries it out herself. To put this in perspective, Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger had to flee the United States in 1914 to avoid prosecution for sharing basic information about contraception. Yet in 2015, One Taste notched a placement on the Inc. 5000, an annual ranking of high-growth companies. The popularity of orgasmic meditation makes sense once you understand what it can do. In French literature, University of Pennsylvania neurologist Anjan Chatterjee explains in his book, The Aesthetic Brain, the release from orgasm is famously referred to as la petite mort, the little death. The person is in a state without fear and without thought of themselves or their future plans. This pattern of deactivation could be the brain state of a purely transcendent experience, enveloping a core experience of pleasure. Social scientist Jenny Wade has spent her career studying these same phenomena. The fact is, sex, all by itself, she writes in her book, Transcendent Sex, can trigger states identical to those attained by spiritual adepts of all traditions. By Wade's estimate, nearly 20 million Americans have had at least one encounter with boundary-dissolving, self-obliterating sex. It's happened to countless thousands of people, regardless of their background, she notes, to hairdressers, investment managers, nurses, lawyers, retailers, and executives. But if 20 million of us have experienced transcendent sex, why aren't we talking about it more often? Most volunteers said they had never confided their experiences to their lovers, Wade reports, for fear their partners would make fun of, not be interested in, or not be receptive to spiritual stuff. Yet it's not only the spiritual stuff that gives people pause. Sometimes it's merely who's doing what with whom, and what would the neighbors think. For most of the 20th century, we had no idea what people were up to in their bedrooms or what normal actually looked like. Long after Masters and Johnson and Kinsey and Company did their best to extract honest answers from modest people about their sex lives and were consistently lied to. Men overestimated the length of appendages, women sandbagged on their number of partners, and everyone fudged when reporting edgier behavior. We still tend to keep our most intimate thoughts and experiences under wraps. But technology is helping to lift that veil, creating a digital commons where we can discreetly bypass nosy neighbors to explore our actual desires. For the past 5 years, the French research group Sexualitics has been building the Porngram, an analytic tool to track online sexual behaviors across the world. Traces left by billions of users give us cultural snapshots of tastes, they wrote in their 2014 paper, Deep Tags Toward a Quantitative Analysis of Online Pornography. More importantly, they enable researchers to look for structures and patterns in the evolutionary dynamics of practices adopted by a significant and growing proportion of the human population. And the biggest pattern revealed by this data is that we're more curious about the outer edges of human sexuality than at any other time in history. And this includes women, who now make up a third of all online porn viewers. Simply judging by today's top search terms, an assortment that would make a sailor blush, we find a greater interest in activities that, until recently, were considered deviant by psychiatric professionals or prosecuted outright by law. Take, for example, BDSM, short for bondage, discipline, sadism, and masochism, a category that includes a range of intense pleasure-pain stimulation and role play. Until recently, BDSM was mostly practiced by a fringe subculture, and at some risk. In America, evidence of these behaviors was admissible in court as grounds for divorce or denial of child custody. But in 2010, the American Psychiatric Association agreed to redefine aberrant sexual behavior in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Bible for Mental Illness Classification, making a clear distinction between elective play and actual pathology. For the first time, consenting adults weren't considered morally deviant or mentally ill for choosing sexual behavior that was beyond the pale. Which was just in time, considering the following year, E.L. James published Fifty Shades of Grey. A critically panned but wildly popular novel, Fifty Shades cataloged the BDSM-driven sexual awakening of a college student at the hands of a handsome young billionaire. It became one of the fastest-selling books in history and sold more copies on Amazon than all of J.K. Rowling's 7-volume Harry Potter series combined. But if it wasn't literary merit that vaulted this book into a global phenomenon, what was it? You could make a case that, in the same way that electronic dance music thrives largely because of its ability to generate a shift in state, 50 Shades represents a sexual equivalent. It's a de facto user manual for erotic ecstasis that many of its readers never dared imagine. With this one book, Kindles and minivans replaced brown paper-wrapped smut and trench coats. Edgy sex went suburban. If you get past the snickering, the exceptional popularity of the book is understandable. Beyond simple novelty or variety, this broader range of sexual experiences is giving people access to altered states that vanilla sexuality rarely does. To return to the knobs and levers of ecstasy, we know full-spectrum sexuality contains many of the same triggers that produce stir through meditation, flow states, and psychedelic experiences. Pleasure produces endorphins, but pain can prompt even more. The uncertainty of teasing, as Stanford's Robert Sapolsky established, spikes dopamine 400%. Nipple stimulation boosts oxytocin. Pressure in the throat or colon regulates the vagus nerve, creating exhilaration, intense relaxation, and goosebumps. What Princeton gastroenterologist Anish Sheth memorably terms poophoria. To some it may feel like a religious experience, Sheth writes, to others like an orgasm, and to a lucky few, like both. And momentary erotic transcendence can bring lasting change. A 2013 Dutch study found that kinky sex practitioners were less neurotic, more extroverted, more open to new experiences, more conscientious, less rejection-sensitive, and had higher subjective well-being. Nor are these benefits reserved just for the socially progressive. Minister Ed Young of the Mega Fellowship Church in Dallas, Texas, exhorts his congregation of thousands to the 7 Days of Sex Challenge, where they commit to sex every day for a week to deepen their spiritual union. And when I say intimacy, I don't mean holding hands in the park or a back rub, Young clarified. If you make the time to have sex, it will bring you closer to your spouse and to God. This grassroots movement, combined with growing research, make it clear that sexuality is becoming one of the more popular techniques of ecstasy available today. Once we step beyond taboos and social conditioning, it's easier to see that access to ecstasy has been hardwired into us all along. In the past, you had to risk social or legal censure if you tried to figure it out for yourself. Now there's a broad movement to explore full-spectrum sexuality and elevate it from compulsion or perversion into something more deliberate, playful, and potent. The arc of the moral universe may be long, but it's bending toward the kinky. Good for what ails you. Even with all these new approaches to ecstasy at our disposal, from the est encounter to more adventuresome sexuality, a critical question remains. Can these fleeting moments produce meaningful psychological change? If not, it would be hard to justify their additional risks and complications. If so, they might earn a legitimate spot in the toolkit of personal development. And one of the starkest tests for ecstasy is, can it help survivors of serious trauma? If you can heal them, presumably, you can heal just about anyone. One of the first people to try to address this question was Brown University neuroscientist Willoughby Britton. In the 1990s, Britton became interested in near-death experiences, NDEs, where subjects had transcendental encounters during life-threatening events, including the widely reported Tunnel of Light journey. 30 years of research showed that people who had an NDE scored exceptionally high on tests of overall life satisfaction. As a trauma expert, Britton found this unusual. In her experience, most people who came close to dying were scarred by the event, developing post-traumatic stress and other mental health conditions. But if those studies were right, then people who had a transcendent near-death experience were having a decidedly atypical response to trauma. Britton decided to find out how atypical. After recruiting 23 NDEers and 23 control subjects, she hooked them all up to electroencephalogram, EEG, machines and ran a sleep study. Her goal was both to get a clear picture of brainwave activity and record how long it took her subjects to enter REM sleep, an excellent way to measure happiness and well-being. Normal people go into REM at about 90 minutes. Depressed people enter sooner, usually at 60 minutes. Generally happy people head in the opposite direction, dropping into REM at around 100 minutes. Britton discovered that NDEers delayed entry until 110 minutes, which meant that they were off the charts for happiness and life satisfaction. And when Britton examined the EEG data, she discovered why. The brain firing patterns of her subjects were completely altered. It was as if the NDE had instantly rewired their gray matter. Sure, it was only a single experiment, but it did suggest that even a one-time encounter with a powerful, altered state could impart lasting change. Despite this intriguing result, few studies followed. NDEs posed a serious research challenge. They are, ipso facto, accidental and not easily repeatable in the lab. Then Johns Hopkins neuroscientist Roland Griffiths came up with an elegant solution. Rather than scouring the country for small groups of NDE survivors, Griffiths tapped a much larger population facing death, terminal cancer patients. And instead of waiting for a fleeting and hard-to-replicate tunnel of light journey, he relied on chemistry to produce a similar impact on demand. In 2011, Griffiths gave 3 grams of psilocybin to a group of terminal cancer patients in an attempt to provide them with relief from fear of death anxiety, which is understandably hard to alleviate. Afterward, he administered a battery of psychological tests, including a standard fear of dying metric, the death transcendence scale, at 1 and 14-month intervals. Just as with Britton's NDE survivors, Griffiths found significant, sustained change, a marked decrease in their fear of death, and a significant uptick in their attitudes, moods, and behavior. 94% of his subjects said taking psilocybin was one of the 5 most meaningful experiences of their lives. 4 out of 10 said it was the most meaningful. More recently, researchers have learned that you don't have to be on the verge of dying to experience relief, that an encounter with ecstasy can help the walking wounded as well. In 2012, psychologist Michael Mithofer discovered that even a single dose of MDMA can reduce or cure post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in survivors of child abuse, sexual abuse, and combat. It was completely cathartic, reported an Army Ranger who suffered a broken back and severe head trauma in Iraq. The next day, after just one session, the nightmares were gone. I was glowing and extroverted for the first time since getting blown up. MDMA gave me my life back. To put the options trauma survivors have into perspective, nearly 25 million Americans suffer from PTSD, yet the only 2 drugs approved for treatment are Prozac and Zoloft. Both require weeks or even months to get into our system, while their effects last only as long as we continue taking them. Stop the pills, and you return, more or less, to where you started. In contrast, Mithofer found that the benefits provided by 1 to 3 rounds of MDMA therapy lasts for years. These results outstrip conventional treatments so convincingly that in May 2015, the federal government approved studies of MDMA as a treatment for depression and anxiety. Flow researchers have achieved comparable results without drugs, simply by altering neurobiological function. In 2007, working with Iraq War veterans at Camp Pendleton, occupational therapist Carly Rogers of the University of California, Los Angeles, blended surfing, a reliable flow trigger, and talk therapy into a treatment for PTSD. It was essentially the same protocol Mithofer used, only with the flow generated by action sports, substituting for MDMA. Much like in Mithofer's study, sufferers experienced nearly immediate relief. After just a few waves, they, the soldiers with PTSD, were laughing in the surf lineup, reported Outside Magazine. "Oh my God, our Marines are talking," said the lieutenant who approved the experiment. "They don't talk, ever." Since then, the program has been formalized, and more than 1,000 soldiers have taken part. Hundreds of veterans and surfers have volunteered their time, including 11-time world champion Kelly Slater, and their investment paid off. In a 2014 paper published in the Journal of Occupational Therapy, Rogers reported that after as little as 5 weeks in the waves, soldiers had a clinically meaningful improvement in PTSD symptom severity and in depressive symptoms. And surfing isn't the only non-pharmacological intervention to show promise. A recent study done by the military found that 84% of PTSD subjects who meditated for a month could reduce or even stop taking selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. In contrast, the control group, who didn't meditate and stayed on antidepressants, experienced a 20% worsening in PTSD symptoms during that same period. Taken together, all this work, from the NDE studies to the cancer and trauma research to the flow and meditation programs, demonstrates that even brief moments spent outside ourselves produce positive impact, regardless of the mechanisms used to get there. And they can provide these benefits in the face of the deepest challenges imaginable. Yet in each of these instances, the only people given permission to explore altered states were those, quite literally, in some cases, left for dead. It's almost as if dispensing these techniques to normal people would be unseemly, or at the very least, unscientific. In her book, Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, science writer Sharon Begley highlights this problem, describing the history of psychology as one favoring remediation over transformation. Science has always focused on people and conditions that are pathological, disturbed, or at best, normal. In the past 30 years, there have been about 46,000 scientific studies on depression and an underwhelming 400 on joy. As long as someone can obtain non-sickness, that is deemed sufficient. As Buddhist scholar Alan Watts put it, Western scientists have an underlying assumption that normal is absolutely as good as it gets, and that the exceptional is only for saints, that it is something that cannot be cultivated. But many of the same interventions that can help us get our heads above water can just as effectively be devoted to raising our heads above the clouds. If we're interested in untapped levels of performance improvement and lasting emotional change, peak states of consciousness may provide the quickest path between two points, a shortcut from A to E, ecstasy. Altered states to altered traits. One summer day, while working in the garden with his young daughter, Nikki, University of Pennsylvania psychologist Martin Seligman had, in his own words, an epiphany. Seligman was meticulously freeing weeds with a trowel and neatly setting them aside in a discard pile. Nikki, being 5, was just having fun. Weeds were flying up in the air, Seligman later said. Dirt was spraying everywhere. Seligman, who describes himself as both a serious gardener and a serious grouch, couldn't take it. He started yelling. But Nikki wasn't having any of it. She stomped over with a stern look on her face. "Daddy," she said, "I want to talk with you. From the time I was 3 until I was 5, I whined a lot. But I decided the day I turned 5 to stop whining, and I haven't whined once since. If I could stop whining, you can stop being such a grouch." Seligman decided to take her up on the challenge and bring the field of psychology along for the ride. In 1998, after being elected president of the American Psychological Association, Seligman made positive psychology the central focus of his tenure. "I want to remind our field that it has been sidetracked," he wrote in his first presidential column for the APA's newsletter. "Psychology is not just the study of weakness and damage. It is also the study of strength and virtue. Treatment is not just fixing what is broken. It is nurturing what is best within ourselves." If those trauma studies demonstrated that a few instances of ecstasy can help mend what's broken, then what happens if we deploy these techniques repeatedly over the course of a lifetime? Can recurring access to these states really nurture what is best within ourselves? Can they, as Alan Watts suggested, be used to cultivate the exceptional? Oddly, in the history of adult psychology, the idea that we could cultivate anything over time was considered suspect. After adolescence, the thinking went, adults were pretty much fully baked. Sure, we could learn technical skills like going to business school or picking up a musical instrument, but our ability to add psychological capacities, like the gratitude and empathy that Nikki asked her father to embrace, was believed to be pretty much over and done with by the time we'd graduated from college. But Bob Keegan, the Harvard psychologist whom we first met in Chapter 2, upended that assumption by doing something psychologists before him hadn't done too much of: longitudinal research. Keegan tracked a group of adults as they aged. His goal was simple: understand how they changed and grew over time, and determine if, in fact, there were upper limits to who we can become. Keegan spent 3 decades tracking this group, seeing what happened to their psychological maturity and capacity along the way. He discovered that while some adults remained frozen in time, a select few achieved meaningful growth. Right around middle age, for example, Keegan noticed that some people moved beyond generally well-adjusted adulthood, or what he called self-authoring, into a different stage entirely: self-transforming. Defined by heightened empathy, an expanded capacity to hold differing and even conflicting perspectives, and a general flexibility in how you think of yourself, self-transforming is the developmental stage we tend to associate with wisdom and Roger Martin's opposable mind. But not everyone gets to be wise. While it usually takes 3 to 5 years for adults to move through a given stage of development, Keegan found that the further you go up that pyramid, the fewer people make it to the next stage. The move from self-authoring to self-transforming, for example, fewer than 5% of us ever make that jump. But in all of this developmental research, buried in the footnotes about those self-transcending 5%ers, lay a curious fact. A disproportionate number of them had dabbled in ecstasy, often beginning with psychedelics, and after that, making meditation, martial arts, and other state-shifting practices a central part of their lives. Many of them described their frequent access to non-ordinary states as the turbo button for their development. And this isn't an isolated finding. 50 years ago, psychologist Abraham Maslow noticed that the more peak experiences a person had, the closer they came to self-actualization, his term for the upper stages of adult development. A 2012 study, published in Cognitive Processing, took it further. When examining the relationship between peak experiences and performance in Olympic athletes and corporate managers, researchers found that the highest performers didn't just have more frequent peak experiences, they also made more ethical and empathetic decisions. Boston College's Bill Torbert found that those at the top of the developmental pyramid not only were more ethical and empathetic, they performed better in the workplace as well. In a survey of nearly 500 managers in different industries, he found that 80% of those who scored in the upper two stages of development held senior management roles, despite only making up 10% of the broader population. The most developed leaders, as Torbert noted in the Harvard Business Review, succeeded in generating one or more organizational transformations over a four-year period, and their company's profitability, market share, and reputation all improved. Consciousness, it turns out, goes straight to the bottom line. If the shift in psychology that led us from Esalen to Eckhart was about greater permission to explore, then Keegan and his colleagues have given us the next piece of that puzzle, a map of where we're going. By bridging the gap between peak states and personal growth, these discoveries validate ecstasis as a tool not only for self-discovery, but also for self-development. So while ecstatic states, which are brief and transitory, aren't the same as developmental stages, which are stable and long-lasting, it appears that having more of the former can, under the right conditions, help accelerate the latter. In short, altered states can lead to altered traits. Chapter 5. Neurobiology. Outside the jar. There's a bit of Southern folk wisdom that says, you can't read the label while you're sitting inside the jar. And that notion, that we can't always understand what we're too close to, sums up the relationship between psychology and neurobiology as forces for ecstasis. As substantial as the advances in psychology have been, what they've really done is make the inside of the jar bigger, by expanding our sense of what's possible. But the field of neurobiology is doing something else altogether. By giving us an understanding of the ingredients on the label, it's providing a view of our lives from outside the jar. In the past, we might have seen all of our psychological ups and downs as challenges to be solved with our minds. Now we can address them at a more foundational level, with a clearer view of the knobs and levers being tweaked in the body and brain. Neurobiology provides us with a more precise toolkit with which to tackle life's challenges. To trace these developments, we'll take a look at how Hollywood movie stars clued us into the link between motion and emotion, how webcams and video game sensors are helping revolutionize mental health, how the U.S. military and top business schools are harnessing biometrics to predict the future, and how maverick scientists are reverse engineering ancient mystical experiences. Taken together, these examples will show how neurobiology has given us the tools to map and measure what's happening in our bodies and brains when we're experiencing both the ordinary and the extraordinary. And the results are changing how we think about how we think. I can't feel my face. In February 2011, Nicole Kidman wowed on the Academy Awards red carpet with a silver Dior gown, a 150-carat Fred Leighton diamond choker, and matching Pierre Hardy pumps. Yet beyond her upscale designer choices, Kidman drew attention that evening for an unexpected reason. Her eyebrows. She couldn't not arch them. She looked like a porcelain doll who just sat on a pine cone. And while Kidman repeatedly ascribed her timeless beauty to diet, exercise, and sunscreen, in 2013, she finally admitted to Italy's La Repubblica, I did try Botox, unfortunately, but I got out of it, and now I can finally move my face again. Which is kind of critical if you're an actor who earns a living making faces. Not long after celebrities began showing up at gala events with implausibly blank expressions, researchers started to notice that Botox was doing more than just altering how people looked. It was altering how they felt, too. In study after study, when seriously depressed patients received Botox injections in their frown lines, they got significant and sometimes instantaneous relief from depression. But when Botoxed subjects were asked to empathize with other people, to feel their joy or share their sorrow, they simply couldn't. This struck scientists as strange. Since the time of the Greeks, Western thinkers have considered the mind the engine that drives the bus, and the body the passenger that comes along for the ride. It's the mind-body split, a one-way arrow of causation that insists the head is always in charge and can be trusted to govern our higher aspirations, while the body is the vessel that houses our animal instincts and should be strictly controlled. But these Botox studies pointed in the opposite direction. Somehow, changes in the body, freezing the face with a neurotoxin, were producing changes in the mind, the ability to feel sadness or empathy. The horse appeared to be steering the rider. And we now know why. Our facial expressions are hardwired into our emotions. We can't have one without the other. Botox lessens depression because it prevents us from making sad faces. But it also dampens our connection to those around us because we feel empathy by mimicking each other's facial expressions. With Botox, mimicry becomes impossible, so we feel almost nothing at all. No wonder Nicole Kidman was relieved to get a few wrinkles back. But the bigger point is that these studies reflect a sea change in how we think about thinking. They move us from disembodied cognition, the idea that our thinking happens only in the 3 pounds of gray matter tucked between our ears, to embodied cognition, where we see thinking for what it really is, an integrated whole system experience. The body, the gut, the senses, the immune system, the lymphatic system, explained embodied cognition expert and University of Winchester Emeritus Professor Guy Claxton to New York Magazine, are so instantaneously and complicatedly interacting that you can't draw a line across the neck and say, above this line, it's smart, and below the line, it's menial. In fact, we're not smart and we have bodies. We're smart because we have bodies. The heart has about 40,000 neurons that play a central role in shaping emotion, perception, and decision-making. The stomach and intestines complete this network, containing more than 500 million nerve cells, 100 million neurons, 30 different neurotransmitters, and 90% of the body's supply of serotonin, one of the major neurochemicals responsible for mood and well-being. This second brain, as scientists have dubbed it, lends some empirical support to the persistent notion of gut instinct. And these whole-body perceptions can be easily influenced. If someone gives you a cup of icy cold water to hold, then introduces you to a stranger, as researchers at Yale did, you'll treat this newcomer with suspicion and rate them as colder and more distant on personality scales. But if they give you a cup of hot coffee and make the same introduction, trust comes more easily. The act of feeling physical warmth is enough to trigger a cognitive change. You literally warm up to people, no thinking required. Or consider Harvard psychologist Amy Cuddy's popular TED Talk about the power of body language. Cuddy discovered that spending 2 minutes in a power pose, meaning a posture of dominance, like Wonder Woman, hands on hips, elbows cocked wide, legs firmly planted, changed both psychology and physiology. In her research, subjects who adopted the Wonder Woman posture took greater risks and took them more frequently. And 2 minutes of the pose was enough to increase levels of the dominance hormone testosterone by 20% and decrease the stress hormone cortisol by 15%. While the field of embodied cognition is in its infancy, and there is still lots of work to be done replicating studies and integrating insights, these early findings suggest a tighter linkage between our minds and our bodies than most of us would ever suspect. So what does any of this have to do with ecstasy? For those interested in shifting states, knowing that the body can drive the mind gives us a whole new set of knobs and levers with which to play. Einstein's quote, "You cannot solve a problem at the level at which it was created," is invariably used to encourage higher, more expansive solutions. But the opposite is equally true. Sometimes lower, more basic solutions can have just as big an impact. In our work training flow, for example, we found that action and adventure sport athletes deliberately amplify the physical sensations of gravity to help shift their mental state. Whether it's boosting G-forces by carving hard turns on skis or mountain bikes, or nullifying G-forces with jumps, spins, and airs, these athletes expand the range of normal bodily inputs to push themselves into the zone. Weightlessness, weightedness, and rotation are the nectar of gravity games, explains professional climber and filmmaker Jimmy Chin. They provide easy access to flow, and that's what keeps us coming back for more. Really, none of this is new. 5,000 years ago, early yoga practitioners were tinkering with embodied cognition to prompt higher states of awareness. If simply standing like Wonder Woman for a few minutes is enough to produce meaningful changes in our hormonal profile, imagine what practicing a full sequence of yoga postures every morning would do. There's all this evidence that movement sequences have an impact on stress. Peter Strick, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh's Brain Institute, writes in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, "It has an effect on how you project yourself and how you feel." 1,500 years ago, Shaolin monks in China became the ultimate Buddhist warriors by training their bodies to elevate their minds. They spent years practicing nearly impossible physical feats, smashing bricks with their hands, stopping spears with their necks, balancing all their weight on two fingers, as a way of training their minds. In direct contrast to skin-and-bone ascetics who sought ecstasy by ignoring or denying the body, these monks believe transcendence began with its total mastery. In the West, though, we inherited a different legacy, that mind-body split. It began with a healthy dose of Judeo-Christian guilt, that our bodies were not to be trusted, and was cemented by an increasingly industrial economy, where our bodies were less and less needed. And today, with so much of our emotional and social lives mediated by screens, we've become little more than heads on sticks, the most disembodied generation of humans that has ever lived. But if we draw upon the insights of embodied cognition research, we can reconnect our bodies and brains. We can shift posture, breathing, facial expressions, flexibility, and balance as a way to tune our states of consciousness, altered or otherwise. We don't have to process everything first and foremost through our psychology. We can flip the script entirely and change our experience without having to think much at all. Funkmaster George Clinton once sang, "Free your mind and your ass will follow." But he might have had it backward. "Free your ass and your mind will follow." AI Shrink. In 2014, we traveled to the University of Southern California to meet an entirely new kind of therapist who's taking the insights of embodied cognition and turning them inside out. Rather than using bodily changes to impact mood, she's measuring bodily expression to unearth deeper psychological conditions. Her name is Ellie. She's a professional woman in her early 30s with olive skin, brown eyes, and brown hair worn in a ponytail. She dresses demurely in a blue scoop-necked shirt, a brown cardigan sweater, and a teardrop pearl around her neck. In conversation, her questions are straightforward and inquisitive. Where are you from? How are you feeling today? Occasionally, as when Stephen tells her he's from Chicago, Ellie reveals a bit of personal information. Oh, she says, I've never been there. I'm from L.A. myself. And while that much is true, Ellie is, technically, from Los Angeles, she was less born there than built there. She's the world's first artificially intelligent AI shrink. Created by researchers at DARPA and USC's Institute for Creative Technologies, Ellie's designed to identify signs of depression, anxiety, and PTSD in soldiers. She's part of a larger Defense Department initiative to identify mental health concerns earlier and stem the tide of suicide in the military. Aside from the fact that Ellie appears only on a video monitor, a session with her is about what you'd expect from a traditional therapist. She begins each appointment with rapport-building questions such as, how are you feeling today? She asks direct follow-ups. When was the last time you felt really happy? And weaves in clinical inquiries. How much sleep are you getting? Sessions close with queries intended to boost patients' mood. What are you most proud of? Beneath the surface, though, Ellie is anything but a traditional therapist. Her ability to identify, assess, and respond to emotion in real time is the result of a growing body of research into the mechanics of embodied cognition. The neurobiology of emotion shows that our nonverbal cues, our tics, twitches, and tone, reveal much more about our inner experience than words typically do. People are in a constant state of impression management, explains USC psychologist Albert Skip Rizzo, the director of the institute. They have their true self and the self they want to project to the world. And we know the body displays things that sometimes people try to keep contained. While the research that led to Ellie required advanced brain imaging and a DARPA budget, her ability to track a patient's unconscious tells involves inexpensive, off-the-shelf technology, a Logitech webcam to monitor facial expressions, a Microsoft Kinect movement sensor to follow gesture, and a microphone to capture word choice, modulation, and inflection. Every second, she's noting and processing more than 60 different data points. She constantly scans vocal tone for signals of sadness, for example, with every word rated on a 7-point openness scale, that is, willingness to disclose revealing information. An array of algorithms then analyzes this data and helps provide a clearer picture of a patient's overall well-being. Ellie's the third leg of the stool, explains Rizzo. For the past century, scientists only had good data about two of the three streams of information we can glean from people. There's what people say about themselves, self-reporting, and what the body can tell us. Biophysical data like heart rate and galvanic skin response. But there's also behavior, our movements and facial expressions. These have always been hard to assess, and typically we could only get at them through subjective observations. Ellie gathers objective, high-quality data. With her cameras, sensors, and algorithms, she extends our five senses and gets upstream of our Umwelts, or reality as we perceive it. She bypasses our relentless storytelling and reflects back to us a little more of what we're actually thinking and feeling. And people prefer talking to Ellie than to actual humans. Even trained psychologists tend to judge. Ellie never does. In a 2014 study, the USC team discovered that patients were twice as likely to disclose personal information to her than to a human therapist. The researcher's ultimate goal is to make her available via laptop to anyone with a Wi-Fi connection. AI therapists like Ellie are simultaneously more objective and more perceptive than humans, and they can help us become the same. She gives us distance from our inner critic and a better understanding of what we're perceiving in the present moment. In a very real sense, Ellie's dispassionate reflection of who we are mimics the advantages conferred by ecstasis, the ability to look at ourselves from outside ourselves. So when we next find ourselves thrust into the selflessness of a non-ordinary state, ripped free of our waking identity and its comfortable narratives, it won't be as shocking or disorienting. Ellie's dispassionate reading of our biometrics gives us more accurate insight than our own self-reporting. She can help us close the gap between what Rizzo calls our true selves and the self we want to project to the world. Precognition is here, but you knew that already. In 1999, Steven Spielberg had a problem. How to translate Philip K. Dick's short story, Minority Report, into a box office hit? A cop thriller set in the mid-21st century, Minority Report hinges on mutant humans who can see into the future using their precognition to prevent crimes before they happen. Unfortunately for Spielberg, Dick's book contained few clues as to what this Tomorrowland world actually looked like. So the director pulled together a collection of the world's best futurists to help him color in the storyboards in the most believable way. Jaron Lanier, author and virtual reality pioneer, Sean Jones, the first director of DARPA's Unconventional Countermeasures Program, and the heads of both the Center for Bits and Atoms and the Media Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, all convened at Shudders, a Santa Monica, California beachside hotel, for their secret think tank. While few moviegoers remember the intricacies of Minority Report's plot, nearly everyone remembers the world they created, mostly because they got so much of the future right. Out of all the ideas Spielberg's think tank came up with, they correctly anticipated head-up digital displays, gesture command, driverless cars, personalized advertising, voice-automated home appliances, and predictive crime analytics. At first, the movie was supposed to be set in 2070, but then they dialed it back to 2054. And out of all their educated guesswork, that was their biggest mistake. They were 40 years too late. And not just for the cool tech like driverless cars and head-up displays, but for precognition itself. In 2015, we were invited to Southern California to host an event for Nike's Innovation Group. Every year, to help spark new insights in their own design work, this group goes on creative field trips to learn more about the cutting edges of other fields. That year, Nike wanted to learn about precognition and group flow, and how harnessing the former could get their teams more of the latter. So we designed a think tank of our own. In conjunction with colleagues from Advanced Brain Monitoring, as well as some DARPA researchers and MIT Media Lab hackers, we set out to give Nike a glimpse of a future that was already here, but not yet widely distributed. If you think back to the embodied cognition work of Amy Cuddy, AI Ellie, and others, their big insight was that our bodies, facial expressions, posture, and voice all convey more information than we would ever suspect. And if we change any of those things, we can substantially shift how we feel and what we think in the present moment. That's pretty big news. But what we explored with Nike went even further than that, beyond real-time transformation and into future-time prediction, precognition itself. Chris Burka, the founder of Advanced Brain Monitoring, kicked off the day briefing the group on a few of her team's research projects, starting with one they'd recently completed with the U.S. Navy. The project involved submariners, often considered the roughest job in the military. Getting locked into a tin can for 6 months at a time, never seeing sunlight, and carrying warheads that could start World War III requires a special kind of sailor. It also requires tightly coordinated teamwork and a lot of group flow. The trouble was, it had been next to impossible for the Navy to predict who could weather those conditions and still be able to drop into the zone, and who might end up stabbing someone with a fork at dinner. So that was the puzzle Burka's team set out to solve. First, the Navy built a full-scale dry land replica of a nuclear-class submarine. Next, advanced brain monitoring took teams of submariners, hooked them up to EEG machines to track brain waves and heart rate variability, HRV monitors, to measure the quality of their cardiac rhythms, and then put them through a 16-week training program that simulated all the stresses of actual deployment. Simply by examining the biometric profile of each sailor, Burka and her team could reliably track and identify which sailors were going to excel at collaborative problem-solving. With nothing more than these data printouts, they could tell the difference between a novice team still fumbling around, a sophomore team just starting to gel, and a high-performing team of experts. By the end of the full 16-week program, they could predict, months in advance of actual deployment, which teams were going to be able to flip the switch and drop into group flow together, and which ones ran the risk of flipping out 1,000 feet underwater. By measuring biometrics in the present, they were literally able to see into the murky depths of the future. And the armed forces aren't the only ones interested in finding better ways to predict what's around the bend. In a related study run in Barcelona, Spain, researchers at the ESADE Business School, twice ranked the top business school in the world by the Wall Street Journal, wanted to know if they could identify emergent leadership long before their students graduated. So Burka and her team took 35 MBA students, hooked them up to EEG and HRV monitors, and gave them a case study to solve. Once again, by examining the neurophysiological profile of these students, Burka was able to identify emergent leaders, those individuals who would have an outsize positive impact on the team and its decision-making, in as little as 30 minutes. While there was no correlation between emergent leadership and how much students talked, or even what they said, there was a direct relationship between their neurophysiological responses and those of their classmates. Transformational leaders not only regulated their own nervous systems better than most, they also regulated other people's. In the same way that multiple clocks on a wall end up synchronizing to the one with the biggest pendulum, emergent leaders can entrain their entire teams and create a powerful group flow experience. In this study at ESADE, this shared experience helped the groups arrive at more creative and ethical solutions, as rated by a panel of faculty and experts. Furthermore, these young leaders' ability to create group coherence proved to be a reliable indicator of effective decision-making later in their careers. Until now, this was a latent, invisible capacity, not predictable, and definitely not trainable. Now, thanks to advances in neurobiology, we can map and develop these ineffable skills with little more than some basic sensors and algorithms. Our understanding of the science has progressed to the point where we can not only shift how we think and feel in the present, but also make accurate predictions about how we're going to think and feel in a future that has yet to occur. The birth of neurotheology. Dr. Andrew Newberg doesn't look like a rebel. With his curly brown hair, boyish face, and easy manner, he's more soccer dad than academic cultural outlaw. Nothing about his demeanor suggests that this was the guy to overturn 100 years of scientific thinking. But that's exactly what happened. Back in the early 1990s, science and religion weren't on